T-U-E-R-P-E, March 29, 1867. He married Caroline Gibbard. He was born in Altus, Lorraine, 1841. He was 2 years younger than her husband. He was inducted into the Confederate Army Infantry Division. On April 14, 1862, his first son was born, Richard Turpin. In June 20, 1863, he crossed the Rio Grande into Mexico and deserted the army. April 20, 1864, he sent for his wife and son. July 20, 1865, the second son, Prince Adolf Turpie, was born in Mexico. In 1867, August the 15th, Albert Theodore was born. Richard's wife's mother died in July 19, 1876. On September the 13th, 1877, the third child, a daughter, Marie Alvina Turpie, was born. May the 2nd, 1888, at 8 a.m., Samuel Turpie, Richard's dad, died. He was born January 31, 1806, and was 82 years old, 3 months and 2 days when he died. On January the 5th, 1892, a son, Albert, married ELVI SCHURCHARDT by County Judge Brooks, BRUCKS. They moved to Ballinger, Texas. Ballinger is spelled BALLINGER. Then, on October the 12th, 1892, Fritz married Bertha, BERTHA, Wurzbach, by Reverend, HUMMEL. In September 24, 1899, Richard's brother, Albert, ISODORE, died. He was 4 years older than Richard. They left Germany because Albert was drafted at 18 years of age, so he wouldn't have to go into the service. He was born February the 17th, 1834. Albert. Then, on June the 14th, 1900, Henry married Annie, A-N-N-I-E, Hey, H-E-Y-E. On October the 10th, 1900, Alvina married William Breedy. Jacob Biffert, Richard's father-in-law, died in February the 10th, 1894. He was born March the 10th, 1800. This was Richard's father-in-law. In 1899, on December the 27th, Richard and Caroline moved to San Antonio. They built a house on 224 Sadie Street. This house has been rented until they moved into it. For a while, they lived with Fritz on his farm and then back to San Antonio in 1925. They moved to the Breeden, Alvina, period. Richard died September the 23rd, 1926. Caroline, born February the 19th, 1841, in REICHEN, died March the 2nd, 1928. Henry died November the 25th, 1935, and Fritz died August the 4th, 1944. Albert died July the 18th, 1965, at 97 years of age. William Breedham, born April the 11th, 1873, Alvina's husband, died June the 24th, 1931. Now this is a little excerpt here to be added. April the 20th, 1864, he sent for his wife and baby. On July the 20th, 1865, the second son, Fritz Adolf Turpey, was born in Mexico. September the 13th, 1877, the third child, daughter Maria Alvina Turpey. May the 2nd, 1888, at 8 a.m., Samuel Turpey, Richard's father, died. He was born the 31st of January, 1806. In January the 5th, 1892, a son, Albert, married County Judge Brooks. They moved to Ballinger. In 1867, Albert Theodore was born. Immigration from Germany included not only refugees from famine as an island, but also farmers and artisans with enough funds to start life in the New World, and some political refugees also. A writer from British periodical describes the early stages of that movement. He states, Germany is the only other country besides Great Britain from which immigration takes place on a great scale and is likely to lead to important results. Since the year 1840, she has sent out annually 60,000 settlers, about our own average. In the present year, 1846, the number is stated in the English papers as 80,000. It is very probable that this number will continue for the future and even increase as the predisposing causes are not occasional, but permanent. Not occasional, but permanent in the subsisting state of the country. The reasons which are all powerful there are not the same as actuate us. The results are very different. The chief immigration to America at present is from the Upper and Middle Rhine, the Grand Duchy of Baden, B-A-D-E-N, Wurttemberg, W-U-R-T-E-M-B, like a bird, and then E-R-G, that is W-U-R-T-E-M. B-E-R-G. The two Hesses, H-E-S-S-E-S, and Bavaria. When you are traveling in the spring or autumn on the Strasbourg Road, to see the long files of carts that meet you every mile, carrying the whole property of the poor who are about to cross the Atlantic on the faith of a lying prospect. There they go slowly along, their miserable trundles drawn by such starved, drooping beasts that your only wonder is how they can possibly hope to reach capital H-A-V-R-E alive. Piled with scanty boxes containing their new effects, and on the top of all, the women and children, the sick, the bedridden, and all who are too exhausted with the journey to walk. One might take it for a convoy of wounded, the relics of a battlefield, but for the rows of little white heads peeping from beneath the ragged hood. These are the immigrants from Bavaria and the Upper Rhine who have no seaport nearer than Havre, H-A-V-R-E again. Those from the north of Germany, who are comparatively few in number, sail mostly from Bremen, capital B-R-E-M-E-N. The number of these, likewise, is increasing. Society in Germany is so much more rudimentary than in England that it is remarkable to see this same tendency exhibiting itself in the two nations. In Germany, population is comparatively sparse. In Great Britain, it is dense. In the one, there is great wealth and profound poverty. In the other, the extremes of property rarely exist. The one has large, dominant town population, and the other has fewer towns in proportion than any country in Europe. The dread of destitution is a motive to immigrate in Germany as in England, but not a principal motive. This is clear that the fact that the immigration does not take place in those districts where there is most want, but exists equally where population is dense and where it is thinly distributed. In Westphalia, for instance, a great number of small proprietors have lately sold their lands and sailed for America, each of whom, it is reckoned, has taken with him at least £30 worth of goods and money. The Bavarians immigrate like from the Rhine country, where population is thickly clustered together, and from the upland districts where there are not 80 inhabitants to the square mile. The one great cause of this almost national movement is the desire for absolute political and religious freedom, the absence of all restrictions upon the development of society, and the publication of opinions which cannot be realized at home. The great agitation in society, caused first by the French domination and then by the convulsive rise against it, has never passed away. In that gigantic struggle, when everything rested on the popular soul, the bonds of privilege and class were tactically abandoned and could never henceforth be reunited as before. The promises of having constitutional governments at that time made by the sovereigns to their subjects have been but partially fulfilled. There is nothing that can be called oppression on the part of the government, but there are many restrictions, and the young, the restless, and the imaginative thirst for their ideal freedom, and many of them seek for the realization of utopia in America. Complete religious equality is still more powerful want. Is still a more powerful one in a country where Catholics and Protestants are so nearly balanced, and where the state of parties is such that the minority in faith, though nominally equal in law, must always live under the cold shade of an alien creed. This of itself has urged many across the Atlantic. Another motive has been the great success of some of the earlier settlers. The Shapers, who have immigrated from Germany, have worked wonders in some parts. In 1815, large-scale immigration from Central and Eastern Europe began toward the end of the 19th century. The Germanic and Slavic peoples who moved from this part of the continent sought economic improvement and greater freedom, as had those who had earlier moved out of the West. This immigration was everywhere accompanied by a disruption of traditional peasant communities. A distinguished American social scientist who had the opportunity to study and to observe these developments in Eastern Europe explained the connection between immigration and the collapse of the peasant economy. The old peasant economy was almost self-sufficing. House industry eked out the farm production, the earthware for cooking and the pretty flowered crockery, the wooden utensils for stall and house, the farm tools, bark and rake and plow, wheel and loom and needle and dye pot, all were homemade, and few were the articles that must be bought for money. This old self-sufficient household economy was, however, gradually broken in upon from many sides as industry developed at the expense of agriculture. Even in places where no industry arose, the effect of that which was growing up in the other countries, afar or nearby, made itself powerfully felt. as a money economy with purchase and sale extended the dependence on household production diminished. Money was needed for taxes. The obvious economy of cheap factory textiles and the superiority of iron pots to earthen ones, indeed the temptation of novel wares of various kinds at low prices, all made new demands for money. With these changes went a rise in standards of living. New goods were available and new desires were contagious. At the same time, with this rise in demands, growth of population without growth of industry made an increased pressure on the land. The old peasant economy had represented a fairly stable economic equilibrium. Population was kept more or less at a level by it, since only one son could take his father's place, and consequently it was difficult for more than one to establish a family, unless indeed he went away to seek his fortune. It was the expectation that everything should go on as it had done. This is the essence of custom, and the peasant world is the world of custom. The result of the breakup of the old system of land holding were often disastrous. The peasant, being free to divide his land and feeling that his children all had equal claims, cut up land which was only sufficient to support one household among a number of descendants. The landholder, unable to support himself from his own plot, sought to seek out his living by working for wages in a population where few could afford to hire labor. In some districts, debt contracted under circumstances which put the borrower at the mercy of a creditor and worked havoc. Thus the peasant, with mortgage payments which he could not meet, or with children for whom he could not provide an adequate food supply, saw himself face to face with an intolerable decline of social status for himself or for his children, namely reduction to the position of a propertyless day laborer. This is the string which induces many a man to far overseas or to send out a son to the new land from which men come back with savings. In some cases, the countryside had never supported its population. There had always been an exodus, permanent or seasonable, of some of the men and boys, as for the instance in some Slavic counties. As the dislocation of the old economy became more serious and the mobility of population increased, there were further overflow to Germany for the summer farm work, to the cities to less closely settled districts, to Russia, to Brazil, to the United States. Quicker transportation and, above all, knowledge of the facts opened the way across the sea, and all the requisites for a heavy immigration movement were present. Sometimes the head of the family goes to retrieve the family fortune. Sometimes he sends the most promising son, or a brother goes hoping to earn another to pay. While the grounds of immigration are in the main economic, it is a mistake to suppose that poverty is its cause, in the sense that the greater the poverty of a man or district, the greater the impulse to immigration. Poverty, especially a settled poverty, to which people have adjusted themselves and which finds expression in a low standard of living and perhaps in physical deterioration, is not an initiating force. Rather, it means stagnation and lack of any marginal energy for new undertakings. It is when the habitual balance of family budget is disturbed that a sense of poverty incites to immigration. The maladjustment may be due to a cutting down of income by some disaster, or it may be due to an increase of wants. The result is the same, and this awakening of new wants is a characteristic of our time, affecting one backward region after another. It is extremely contagious, and the news that it is anywhere possible to earn more and to live better calls slumbering forces of energy and unrest into sudden life. Immigration will then result, of their result if there is any opening which promises improved circumstances. For a long time, the difficulties of the voyage between Europe and America exerted a deep influence upon all immigrants. Death claimed many who left their homes with hope in their hearts, and fear of the dangers kept others at home. But even those who came safely off the ships for years thereafter were marked by the trying experience. As if the perils of the ocean and the weather were not enough, the passengers were also at the mercy of greedy captains and ship owners. In early years, when many immigrants were redemptioners who had signed contracts as servants, they were subject to ruthless exploitation. But 60 years later, the New York State Commissioners of Immigration revealed even free passengers who paid their own way were helpless. In 1805, and also in 1865. Toward the end of the 19th century, the steamship shortened the length of the journey and mitigated some of its perils. But Robert Louis Stevenson found that immigration is still a difficult process. These were instructions for German immigrants. This letter was written by a German pastor and was full of practical advice and experienced counsel. It also brings up one of the problems that plagued the immigrant and is illustrative of the darker side of the America's welcome to the newly arrived. Exhausted by the long, hard steerage crossing, unable to speak the language of the country, bewildered and confused, the immigrant was all too often the victim of unscrupulous men who stood around the piers waiting to pounce on a helpless prey. Sometimes working in gangs, sometimes alone, they would run off with the immigrant's few possessions, lead him to swindling landlords, steal his money, and otherwise harass the new arrival. Very often it was the immigrant's fellow countrymen, under the guise of interpreter, who did the worst damage to him. An investigating committee appointed in New York in 1846 reported that it found the German preying upon the German, the Irish upon the Irish, and the English upon the English. It was not until 1847 that conditions were regulated for the immigrant, and with any success. At that time, a state board of immigration was established in New York. Hospitals were built on Ward's Island, and immigrant resting places founded. Finally, in 1855, Castle Garden became the official processing station for all immigrants landing in New York. Here thus is the letter by the German pastor on some practical advice to the German immigrant. The following may generally be said: Dear fellow countrymen, seize every opportunity that offers itself, or rather seek other opportunities to familiarize by ear, memory, and organs of speech with the intonation, words, and pronunciation of the English language. It is the highest importance for every immigrant and the very means of his livelihood. Going hand in hand with the study of the English language, that he finds as soon as possible an occupation adapted to his powers and abilities. Labor is the principal condition of his happiness, but it is not always possible for him to adhere to this form of occupation, especially for those who were numbered in Germany among the more educated classes. What now must all these do? Know thyself by attainments as well as by faults. And in order that thou mayest be able to make a wise use of thy gifts and avoid folly, may be added. Help yourself with the American proverb, and God will help you. But the mistake of many an immigrant is that he waits for days, even weeks, spending in the meanwhile his precious money and his still more precious time. Quietly waiting until some favorable accident comes to his relief. It has been often said that the man must be the victim of his illusion. Sooner or later, he believes he shall find here golden mountains. Happiness without honesty and a well-guided, judicious activity. A planless and unprincipled intention in coming to this country bears its bitter fruits on the very day of arrival. And the longer the immigrant stays without a regular, useful employment, the more he feels embarrassed, his energies failing in his first grief. Nothing can be perhaps more dangerous than the prejudices originating in monarchy in regard to caste, that some are born princes and nobles, some ministers, while others are born subjects, some which can never, never rise, neither they nor their prosperity. Therefore, many immigrants coming from such places bring with them very erroneous views in relation to the natural equality of man. Such ideas must be forever extinguished when he reaches the shores of this land of freedom. Fidelity and merit are the only sources of honor here. The rich stand on the same footing as the poor, and the scholar is not above the humblest mechanic. And therefore, no German ought to be ashamed to follow any occupation which, in a land where the prejudices of rank are so strong, might be perhaps less esteemed. But how can an immigrant obtain ready employment? The judicious and honest German will not wait for weeks and months and remain in his boarding house, lazy and indolent, until the last cent is spent. And he is to be turned out, but he goes instantly into the neighboring towns to seek for a convenient employment. In case he does not pursue his journey without delay in the interior counties, he is not discouraged until he has found at least a means of satisfying his immediate and urgent wants. If you stop in New York or any other place for a few days, be careful in what kind of boarding house you go. It is better to pay much in a clean and decent house than to be under the promise of cheapness. That what is said about the runners is instructions to persons intending to immigrate by a Captain Hale. These instructions are full of practical advice, useful hints, and good common sense, which must have been helpful reading for any traveler. They are also an excellent guide to the understanding of the conditions under which the immigrant travels, what he ate on the long Atlantic passage, and what the well-dressed immigrant wore. The advice on cleanliness is of utmost importance. Cholera, yellow fever, smallpox, and dysentery were often rampant on ships, with the result that one out of every 10 immigrants failed to survive the crisis. Instructions to persons intending to immigrate as to the domestic articles they should take with them, the kind of possessions they should lay in, and their conduct on board ship. By Captain Hale, who sailed from Portsmouth in May 1832 as superintendent of the ship England to Quebec, from where he conducted a considerable number of passengers who had immigrated from Westboro Green, Sussex, up the St. Lawrence and the lakes and afterwards over land near Athens and the Ohio Territory. Okay, now when you have made up your mind to immigrate, you would do well to prepare yourself in the following manner. First, in collecting up your goods for the voyage, select such things only as are of utmost use, the most to be had of necessity, leaving behind you all convincing articles of furniture, because such things will only be troublesome to you, but will put you to more expense than it is to bring. You are either inclined to bear or can afford.